You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
This session here, we're doing Taking Maker Startups to Market. So we're looking specifically to this crew for a debate about the opportunities and challenges facing the micro manufacturers and whether there's any truth to the widespread belief that it's becoming more viable to run a maker business. So I'm going to hand over to Heidi Bell, who is Head of Design Programmes at the Design Council, as our chair. Thank you very much, Rowan.
I'm delighted to be chairing this session. And as Rowan says, we're looking at the opportunities and challenges of micro manufacturers in this discussion, and also whether there's truth about the widespread belief that it's becoming more viable to become a maker business in the UK. And Chris Anderson, in his book on makers, makes a very strong case, as I think we've heard also through a lot of today's discussion, that we're in the midst of a kind of industrialisation of this kind of DIY spirit or a revolution for real stuff. We're hearing a lot of excitement about the maker economy as regards its potential to be at once small and also global, at once artisanal as well as innovative, high-tech as well as low-cost. And it's also possible to start small but get big, and I think we've got some great panellists to comment on some of these ideas this afternoon. On the other hand, I guess, to bring the kind of sceptical note, which I think came through on the RSA report as a question as well, is to see whether the trends we're experiencing are able to really move the needle for the economy, for the manufacturing economy, or waiting to see whether this is a passing fad of any form. So what we'll do is we'll have 45 minutes of chat, as with other panels, on kind of making it as a maker and on the future of micro manufacturing. And I'm delighted to have a great panel to have this discussion with this afternoon. Fee Scott, to my left here, is the founder of MakeWorks, which is an independent design organisation facilitating and celebrating local manufacturing, making and craftsmanship. And in 2013, I think, Fee took a MakeWorks tour, which was a 90-day road trip across Scotland, finding, mapping and filming 120 factories, material suppliers and workshop facilities that could be used by artists and designers. So really getting out there and experiencing it firsthand. The information has been collected and she's used it to launch an open access directory of local factories, MakeWorks, which also runs residency programs, cultural projects, and produces a publication. Fee is trained as a product designer at Glasgow School of Art and has previously worked around the world. To my immediate right, I've got Lawrence Kemble-Cook, who's founder and chief executive of PaveGen, which is a floor tile technology that converts kinetic energy from human footfall to renewable electricity. So Lawrence entered the RSA Student Design Awards after the post office brief in 2004 and 5, and he developed the PostPod, which was a wireless unit that made it easier for postmasters to set up mobile post office services to remote communities. And his entry won £5,000, from which he has established PaveGen Systems, which is using a renewable form of energy to power street lighting and other forms of street furniture. Now secured contracts to supply installations around the world and employs at least 20 staff with a turnover of at least 20 million, as I understand. So we'll hear much more about this kind of story from Lawrence shortly. Andy, on the end, is a creative technologist and is a co-founder of FabLab, which set up about a year ago, I understand. It's the City of London's first purpose-built FabLab. Andy enjoys exploring the intersection of science, technology and art, and has founded and produced events and networks to enable a lot of the discussion about the future of this, Big Data Week, Science Rewired. I also understand, I meant to ask you about this earlier, Andy, that you've run ridiculous marathons. I don't know whether ridiculous is any more than just the 26 miles involved, but maybe more later. And finally, we've got Roland Ellis, who's a designer based at Makerversity in Somerset House, so no stranger to how it feels to manufacture in the heart of a city. Roland's projects have ranged from classic lighting design to Arduino-based bookbinding, and he's made a living with a lot of sort of forward-thinking projects around taking ideas to new uses. Roland's a graduate from Brunel and has previously worked for studios Wolfgang Buttress, Troika and Random International. So a great discussion with this panel this afternoon. I'm head of design programs at the Design Council, and among other things, one of the things that I do is run a program called Design Council Spark, which is really looking at how you can find and support inventors from anywhere. And I've done a lot of work over the past 10 years in sort of taking startups in the creative world to market. So to kick off the discussion, I thought I'd just ask each of the panel members maybe to give us a two-minute introduction, really, on what their own hopes and fears are about the future of this economy. Anyone like to start? Lawrence?
So I guess I'm an industrial design engineer, and I first walked in this building, age 22, thinking, this is a crazy idea, it's never going to work. I got the £5,000 funding for it, spent 2 years in my bedroom with a prototype trying to build it. Every VC said, forget it. All the government advisory groups said, forget it, it will never work. And my university said they'd help me if I gave them 75% of that business. So it didn't really get anywhere. I then, with my prototype, broke into the South Bank, installed it illegally overnight, took a photo of this illegal installation, put it on my website saying, celebrating our latest installation. I was the only one who celebrated. We closed a 200K deal with one of the largest shopping centre groups in the world through them thinking the product was real. There's a huge chicken and egg. So it worked. It worked from that. I believe as an entrepreneur, you should know no boundaries. I've done everything from being arrested at Downing Street for illegally installing my product to be beaten up by breaking into North Korea to try and install my PaveGen products there. But what we've done over the point is we've taken an idea to mass production in thousands of units. I've used manufacturers in the UK, India, China, all around the world. I don't do it in the UK anymore, simply on a cost issue. But throughout that journey, we've set up in over 200 sites around the world, using the energy of footsteps in a way it's never been done before. We've got a really, really strong patent portfolio. We've got an amazing engineering design team who are focused on how to make something, but how to make it for manufacture. And there's a huge gap in the UK on really great design for manufacture hardware individuals. And I guess through my journey, transitioning from a kind of hack lab style, just me, a stool, a bits of metal, duct tape put together, to visiting factories all around the world and actually establishing those production lines, to right now, last month we closed a £2 million funding round, the quickest grossing crowdfunding round in history in clean tech. We went to raise £700,000. We ended up raising £2 million. So it was really exciting for us. I'm now building out big production lines to do volume to take our product to the next space. I am looking at the UK, but I'm also looking elsewhere because it's really easy to do that right now. We specifically manufacture in Romania. Some of the things that have, I guess where we're working on is we're rolling out in the US with directly with the mayor of Washington. The PaveGen will be powering areas outside of the White House. We're also doing large installations across Singapore, Korea, and Australia. And recently, even 4 days ago, we covered the lanes in Brighton with our largest UK array, and it's now powering all the Christmas tree lights in Brighton from people walking. And you can also see it in Heathrow Airport, where it was our second largest UK array, where all the corridors in T3 are powered using the kinetic energy of footsteps. But our challenge is, how do we make a product really cheap, really, really efficient, but also super durable? And we have to find the right manufacturing partners to do that. So really excited to talk more about our experiences today as a kind of engineering-led entrepreneur.
Thanks, Lawrence. Andy, do you want to talk about your experience, hopes and fears of where we're heading?
I think from the perspective of my life in the Fab Lab over the past, I think, 2 years, it's clear from the kind of fake it till you make it approach that I've been doing for the past 20 years that you can create and make a business if you're passionate enough and driven enough to see it through. And that's something we see a lot of in the lab on a regular basis. And I think the infrastructure within the UK is growing. At the moment, there are, I think, 40 labs in the open workshop network in London and around 15, probably maybe 65 by the end of 2017, as Barclays are about to roll out a series of 50 Eagle labs, which are effectively Fab Labs across the UK. So there is the appetite at senior levels within large corporate organisations, not only to, I guess, build social value and social cohesion using kind of Fab Lab as a network, but also create value for the individual. From my knowledge of the network within the UK and our links to, I guess, it's typically kind of the Far East, people like PCH International do provide that kind of leg room and growth opportunity for small businesses to grow really quickly and accelerate from, let's say, 100 units to 10 million. But there are some gaps in terms of how do the individuals, let's say, average Joe or Jane in the street who has an idea, walks into a Fab Lab, prototypes it. They don't know the process to go through to create your liquid mold injection, to create your circuit board, to create optimum efficiency in chips. And there is a gap, I think. I think that's the biggest challenge from my perspective that we need to kind of face as a kind of maker community. Running a maker business is a completely different kettle of fish, as I understand. And you'll never become rich running a Fab Lab or a makerspace or a hackerspace. Obviously, they serve different purposes. but supported with some kind of equity mechanism like a fund or an accelerator, that's where you start to create value for the space and they become a real value for communities to be able to develop businesses and products really quickly. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Fee, would you like to comment on your hopes and fears, I suppose, for the...
Quite a lot of hopes and fears for the manufacturing industry. MicWorks is... Most of my time is spent in industrial estates. We go and find mainly small-scale batch production manufacturers, also material suppliers, so your tanneries, your sawmills, that kind of thing. And we document them, and so anyone can know who to contact, basically. And so it becomes a much less intimidating experience to go and get something made. My hope and fear is that people actually use these brilliant, brilliant fabricators and commit to doing that. I know there's a cost issue. I know there's all these other things around wanting to make your business the biggest growing, fastest growing business. But actually, I really want to live in a country where we have skills. We have people have an understanding of how to use their hands. Fixing a thing is totally normal because if you don't know how to do it, you'll know a metal worker who does and you just have that conversation. That's just kind of how it's done. And that becomes the normal thing that is across this country and around the world. And I think that kind of conversation about local and then how do you make that into a much larger scheme of things is really interesting. Like, can you email your designs to halfway around the world for your customers around that side of the world and they make it there rather than shipping finished products? So that participatory side of things. My fear is that it dies off because it is really fantastic. We should keep supporting it and going to use these people because they're amazing. So, yeah.
Thank you. And finally, Roland?
Certainly. I definitely mirror that. The one thing that I haven't maybe wasn't mentioned before is that actually I worked in China about 10 years ago in manufacture. And so then coming back to UK and being a designer working in various studios, I really hope that manufacturing does continue to go, carry on in this country. My father and also my brother are in the industry as well. My brother's only 21. He's just doing an apprenticeship now. And in the makerspace, there's some place that I really enjoy, and I hope that the community thrives. I was in there this morning cutting something on the CNC, so...
Thank you, great. I wonder if I could pick up on some points that both Fee and Andy, I think, were making, really, about the gaps in understanding between people working in different parts of an idea development. And you talked a little bit about the kind of normalising of conversations. I guess your whole project was about normalising conversations and enabling those conversations between manufacturers and designers and makers of any form. Whether you feel that what the kind of opportunity is there to bridge that, if there is an opportunity, and what we should be doing about it to enable more of the gaps to be filled?
I mean, I think language is a huge thing, like the amount of design students. I know, like, I came out of art school I went into the workshop quite a lot, but actually I learned most of my making skills based on doing internships and apprenticeships in factories over the summer, which was an incredible experience. But, you know, coming out of art school or coming out of any institution and not understanding how things are made and then expecting that you can go into manufacturing or you can get your product manufactured, like, that just doesn't make any sense. I think that's maybe... And then bringing people together, I mean, it is quite simple as well. Like, I think, I mean, what we do is online, and it's very much open access online. Some of our most successful things we do is when we get manufacturers and designers and artists in the same room, and we make them speed date, so they meet each other and they realise that they're all just humans trying to make things. And it's kind of, it's just bringing those industries together. I think this morning, what I was a bit frustrated with was we're talking about this new economy and this new vision of what we could have with manufacturing, and like, who's bringing the actual manufacturers, the small scale family run firms? Like, why are they not in this room today, kind of thing? Talk to everyone. I think that's the open up outside your own bubble.
I think there's also a bit of a naivety. I mean, I was educated in the early 90s, which kind of gives me my age a little bit. I think that's my degree. And that when you create a product, I think in the world of Etsy, you can create many things on a really small scale, crafted, bespoke for the individual, and you do small runs, and it works, and it's kind of a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It depends on the individual. If they're looking for scale and like a Facebook or an Instagram of the hardware world, because that's the space I'm trying to move into. I'd like to retire early. I think that there's a gap in that, you know, when you create your product, what about CE certification? What about power supply, 110 volt versus 240, the US, Europe? What about safety concerns? You're making things for children under the age of 13 or 9. What about materials you're going to use? And there's a, from my experience in working with a lot of individuals in the lab, they come in with a great idea, they get to a prototype, it's like, okay, I want to get to market. How do I go from 100 to 10,000? And it's a child's lamp. And the first question you ask is, how are you going to certify it? And they're looking up, what do you mean certify it? So I think there's a gap. I think some of that gap can be, I guess, you know, augmented in education. Maybe the industrial designer has that aspect and they go their masters or their PhDs. So there's actually almost like a vocational piece to getting the product to market, because the machines are now with us. Lasers can cut laser machines, so the machine can make the machine. The 3D printer can print parts of the 3D printer. So the more of these machines, the more the resolution of the machine becomes is increased, that the quicker the machines can make more machines. And once you get the knowledge to use the machines, you start making more things with it. And then almost like an open economy of products that get to market quicker, but without the certification, who's liable for that product that gets to market? You know, I mean, recently I had a 2-day hackathon in with Goldsmiths. It was called Hackcess, and we had WizKids, which are a charity for kids with wheelchairs, Autodesk, and Ultimaker. And we basically had a team of designers, engineers, and coders and hackers cranking out these ideas for the wheelchair users. They were there for 2 days, these four kids. Amazing experience. And but then one of the children, I think it was Harriet, took the device away that somebody had 3D printed. And within a day, the charity was on the phone to the designer, what the hell do you think you're doing giving these children these devices? They haven't been certified. So you can imagine, child goes across the road, thing breaks, stops, locks in the wheel, car hits, so who's liable? So there's lots of scenarios like that. And I don't think some designers are prepared for that. They've been through that process, but I think there's a gap in that perspective. There's lots of gaps, but that's, you know, one gap that we're seeing.
Yeah, did you want to pick
up? Yeah, I mean, before our product was certified, we know we needed to test it. And we said, well, where can we test it? So I said, well, if I broke into my old school, there's a chance that there'd be less time between them phoning the police and me installing it, because hopefully they knew who I was. So we broke into the school, we installed it. We had no CE marking. We had no compliance on any British standards at all. We put it in there, and the kids went crazy over it. They wouldn't stop jumping on it. The school, an hour later, placed an order for £10,000 of the product. So it seemed like it worked. But then we had to quickly rush and find out what the standards were. There were no standards for a floor that generates energy from your footsteps. It took us 6 months of research to actually go down the lines of creating our own one, and is that a barrier to market, stop other people to doing it? We realised, you know, if we're going to raise £500,000, do we really want to spend 100k on some standards, or should we go and actually focus on product? So we found the easiest standards we could and made it compliant to that. And obviously, things like if you put it in a train station and someone stands on a tile and it generates energy, that's great. But if it interferes with the navigation equipment on a train and it kills a whole trainload of people, you're in big trouble. So, you know, things like EMC were vital. We spent ages zapping the product and making sure that it didn't emit rays over a certain area. But that was certainly a massive learning experience that I was never taught about. I didn't even know it existed until, you know, we got into that point.
And we were like, point in 5 years from now where it's affecting your brainwaves.
Now it's so important for us. We're ISO 901 compliant. So as a company, and our management procedures have to go through that. And every new product iteration, you have to quickly go and test. So we need to make machines to test our product that have to outlive, okay, they have to outlive me. These things are going to go for like 50 years of just non-stop destruction testing our product. And we had to invent those machines because we couldn't buy them. And that was like, took me 2 years to figure that out in the early days. So it's really important.
Yeah. I mean, it's picking up on something I think the last panel we're talking about a little bit, about this kind of what's the right space to be in, figuratively and physically, in terms of transitioning from one phase of a development of an idea to the next. And I think, you know, from your point, Andy, about the kind of fake it till you make it, to I guess your tactic of a little bit do it till they catch you, actually there seems to be a kind of a place that the makerspace stroke kind of this phase of development is it a necessity that you're going through this kind of experimental,
there's a point where you're disrupting a market, you're literally introducing something that's so radical and so new that there isn't legislation in place to accommodate or test it, and that's what spaces like, say, a Fab Lab, Makerspace or Hackspace should be doing on a weekly, daily basis, because we're going to evolve as a human race to solve all the kind of world issues. And so that innovation, it's the legislation that will never catch up anyway in time, irrespective of how quickly we innovate. And so your model of breaking to school with some kids and trying to work it, obviously at the time it worked, thankfully nobody died, but you've got a great product at the back of it, you know. So it's taking those risks that are, I guess, relatively safe and low impact, that aren't going to harm people.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if I could take it back to this kind of wider question and maybe pick up on Roland's point earlier on about how much easier is it to become a kind of designer and maker a business now in the UK. Could you talk about your experience on that?
I think it's very easy. I think the tools are there, and I think with a space like Makeversity, there's a peer review system. So going back to this point of the getting somebody certified or something like this, the knowledge base is all there in that community, and the first thing that when you start talking to someone in this sort of space is they describe their project that they're working on, and then you'd refer to three other people that have a similar background, or so it might be advantageous for you to have a chat with them, and then instantly you have years of experience at your disposal.
Anybody else want to comment on
that? I totally agree with that. That kind of like pay it forward system. I remember when I started, I was instantly introduced to lots of other people that sort of could see the potential and what I was trying to do and this kind of thing. And then now if I get like students approaching me or anyone else who's just starting out, it's an instant, yeah, come into the studio, let's have a chat, and then we can help each other out. I think it's a very, like, that's something that, like, is to be supported and is very, I think I really notice a difference in that from the design community. And then I guess my other hat is I'm in the tech community, which there is an element of it, but sometimes there's a little bit more, mm-hmm. I guess, protection around ideas sometimes. So I guess it's been quite nice to, yeah, have both.
Yeah. Is there a moment of transitioning out of these sort of spaces and into business?
I think very much so. I mean, so I've been maybe working in the design industry for 9 or so years, and I think at the minute it works for me very well, and the people that are around me are, some of them are a very similar position, and eventually I want to go into more manufacturing, and so it won't necessarily work so well for me, because it's really for meeting people and mm-hmm. for developing ideas and being inspired as well. So this summer we managed to make 1,000 items within Somerset House, and they were PCBs that were digitally bound as books. But yeah, doing that at any larger scale, obviously it has to be done remotely, and so you could have an office in that particular place, but you get to a certain point where you need to have be detached from it, but then you become part of the later community where you can go back to events and still be inspired by what's going on, and potentially have new employees coming through our system as well.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's never been easier to be like an entrepreneur. We could probably disappear for half an hour, come up with an idea and a sketch, put it on Kickstarter at the end of the day. If it was really cool, we could do like $4 million in the next week, and then suddenly everyone's bought it, and then we go, right, how are we going to make it? I think, like, it's so easy. It's almost dangerous how easy it is right now. According to Forbes, 543,000 companies have started up in America every month, and of this, 90% fail within the first 18 months. So I think it's easy for an industrial designer to make a product and sell it, but those skill sets of a designer are often not right to actually build a proper business that, in a way, like, I'm an industrial vertically integrated enterprise. You know, I research, I design, I manufacture, I install, I decommission. That's a real headache. Like, I can't believe I've actually taken it to that point. But you need to be so careful to, like, fulfill these orders. And we've just seen the first batch of Kickstarter projects failing. And there was a drone that was like a little fly, and that they raised $3 million and they went under. And there's a lot of upset people out there. And more and more people who get upset, it's going to mean legislation comes in that wipes the whole maker scene off the face of the earth, because there have been these failures, because the government has to protect consumers. So I think there needs to be, maybe, and I think like PCH International do come in and like sit next to the designer and say, look, we'll ship 1 million products for you. You don't need to worry about that. And that's great. And I think we need a bit more support between big companies, because some massive companies are turning up out of, you know, Pebble, and these little ideas are turning into huge things. So I think there needs to be an extra layer of support there, so it doesn't all just disappear in 10 years' time.
I think
some legislation against Kickstarter to prevent that drone crashing, because effectively I'm now a creditor for that, because they've gone into administration. Yeah, yeah. And so is one of the co-founders. I think it's a bit drastic to say the maker community will collapse if we don't get it right. But I think that things like Kickstarter, Crowdcube and Seed is a different than equity-based place, regulated by the FSA. But things like Indiegogo, Kickstarter, Crowdpatch are all really easy ways to get products to market. You can make short runs of a product, but that also means that there's less waste as well. You're not producing 10 million widgets for 2 million kids, and the rest end up in a dump site, like the Atari games, if you ever saw a story from the 70s and 80s. Yeah, okay. So it's trying to avoid that scenario. So kind of the whole circularity, the recycling piece, for me, Kickstarter and Etsy offer that opportunity to get products to market really quickly. But on the point of maker businesses, is Birdseye a maker business? They make fish fingers, yeah? Is McDonald's a maker business? They make burgers. To me, a maker business essentially is a maker space, a fab lab, a hack space. And the byproduct of those things coming out of those are businesses, startups, not maker businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a maker business, as a maker within a fab lab, they are really difficult to make them sustainable. Just financially, we're very lucky to be based about 90 seconds from the bank. No, 90 seconds from the bank tube and four, a stone's throw from the Bank of China. We're right in the heart of the city. And we have very favourable terms with our landlords, the Mercers. But we've been very fortunate to be able to take that from a standing start in a year and be sustainable, mainly because of the kind of rent and rates are not what the chaps across the road are going to pay.
Mm-hmm.
I know Somerset House has been quite fortunate with their property. But if you're in a city, let's say Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, you're going to have to pay rent and rates. And it also depends where you're located. If you're in the community, you can work off a membership model. If you're in the city, at 5 o'clock, everybody goes home or they go to Brown's across the road. And so our model is completely different to everybody else's. It's more about slightly more consultancy, more about events and sponsorship and raising the awareness of funding through different means as opposed to having a core membership base, which is what the Maker guys do, Maker mm-hmm. Business guys. It's a different model. We don't have desk space.
Yeah.
So I think Maker Business to me, it means two things.
Yeah. I mean, in that comment you just made about maker businesses versus businesses that have some sense of sustainability or exiting the maker spaces, it seems to me that you're kind of landing on a kind of, is this a question we need to be dealing with? Is what's the kind of sustainability of them? Is this a kind of sustainable practice? And I wonder, maybe the question is about what you think are the kind of interventions we might need, whether it's at policy level, whether it's actually, to your point, I guess, Lawrence, about there's more support required to make the chain unbroken, really, so that there's a sort of sustainable economy in all of this. Is the one ask that you would give to I don't know, the central government, local government, some other form of kind of somebody with some clout in all of this to say this is the change we need to see?
I think for me it would be fix it, don't throw it. And that, for example, I can now buy a Hewlett-Packard printer for about £20 inkjet, but I need to replace the plug on the one I've lost that's going to cost me £26. Do I throw the old printer and buy a new one, or do I replace the one I've already got? So there's a question around the manufacturing of these machines. Obviously, they come down in price, things get faster, get quicker. That's a question I think that I can't answer. I don't know what the answer to that one is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a question on education, which is how do you educate from a very young age about how do you fix and mend things mm-hmm. using a fab lab that's on, or a maker that's on your street corner, or a shared space, or a shared shed, or whatever. There's a whole model there that yet to unfold. And there's one of cost. You know, who's going to pay for all of this? So that when we generate all these funky new hardware devices and send them out, who's going to pay for the cost of the update, the maintenance, the shipping? Software's dead easy. You just send it up late through the App Store. Hardware's completely different, which I'm sure you realise as time goes by.
Yeah.
I wonder if I can ask that to the other three on the panel, really. Could you say what the one thing is that you would ask of anybody you think has some power to make a change to help the maker economy to develop and scale?
I'm going to say trust is a massive thing, just in terms of trusting artists, trusting designers, trusting manufacturers, like, and everyone trusting each other, and also, I guess, from a government and funders' point of view. I think actually a common theme across everyone on this panel is that I was told no a lot of times, and that's actually why we ended up doing the tour to start MakeWorks. And it was a student project to begin with. Everyone was like, this is crazy, you're never going to find all the manufacturers, it doesn't exist in this country anymore. You turn down that many times, and then you're kind of like, well, screw this, I'm going to do it myself. And then you do it, and then because it's a thing, people believe it's a thing, and then it actually becomes a real thing. And I think that's kind of, trust that people, when they come up with new ideas, like, I think there's definitely, when the other side of it is, I think the fact that someone can upload a 3D printed object and photograph it nicely and put it on Kickstarter, and then they don't actually know how to manufacture things, is not good, and it's not good design. Quite frankly, people should be able to design for manufacture, and that's, it's really important to understand both of those things. But, trust is the overall thing.
I think before you get to that point of meeting fabricators, then the networks, I think, is probably the point I'd make, because I think mm-hmm. that's just super important. That's why it's really cool what you're doing. I use various networks all the time to connect with manufacturers, and I don't know how I'd do it without it. I think that's the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the Open Workshop Network in London is fantastic. Like Liz Corbin and Zoe, I think, is in today somewhere. They've done a great job to connect, I think, 45 different labs, from bronze sculpture, railway steam guys, to metalwork, woodwork. That as a community works really well in London. I don't know how it operates outside London, like in Liverpool or Manchester or Hillmanport, but they're having that kind of network of, I need a kiln, and half an hour later back, I've got one, it's available at 3 o'clock, great, let's go and use it. That community piece is so beneficial for us, and I guess other people who are part of it as well.
Yeah.
So community.
Continue networking.
Yeah, social cohesion and community. Yeah.
I guess the word I'd use to describe would be like people have got a belief. I think now we're seeing the first $1 billion valuation hardware companies. So Fitbit, GoPro, Nest, you know, they've all, you know, flotation or big exits have just happened, proving that actually investors can get good returns. You know, that's what it's about. We're all in the world of we need capital to grow our businesses. Banks don't exist as far as I'm concerned. You know, they barely give any capital to businesses that don't have 5-10 years of trading history. So I think we need people to believe in hardware startups. Now, could that be done through the government giving an incentive to help them to like a loan? But then there's obviously issues around competition law. You know, the Chinese government recently put massive cash into a very low interest rates to all the solar companies in China. That knocked out all of Europe's solar manufacturers. So, you know, and there is legal proceedings going on around that. I think the enterprise investment scheme that's been introduced by the government that gives 50% tax rebate to anything people invest in companies is brilliant in the UK. We have one of the best ecosystems for early stage investing, which means there's been quite a nice funnel through of hardware businesses getting into that. But we need people to believe. We need investors to say, I'm going to make some money out of this, because that's how we're going to actually make it happen. So if we can all have faith and hopefully GoPro and Fitbit and all these other amazing hardware companies are going to start to flourish and really show everyone that hardware is the way forward.
On the GoPro, it's interesting, there's been a lot of Chinese imports coming from eBay that have actually started to really impact their bottom line, and that's probably because obviously China doesn't always adhere to copyright and design patents, but the fact that as machines become of a higher resolution, the ability to create your own GoPro in your house is, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 years away, and therefore there's a question around design and copyright and patenting that's going to approach every company from Lego through to Bird's Eye when you start printing your fish fingers at 5 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon.
Fish fingers is a maker business. I like that. I'm going to open out to the floor now. Anybody got questions for the panel?
Sorry, at the risk of kind of just asking the same question. Well, I am going to ask a similar question again about growth and scale. And I just, you know, state a claim. You know, my business is called Small is Beautiful, based on the Schumacher approach to economics, which is that which is an economics that's grounded in sufficiency of consumption, opportunities for people to participate in useful and fulfilling work, and vibrant community life marked by peace and cooperative endeavour, something that's really important given what's going on in the UK today. And I'm just really curious why we keep defaulting to high growth as high growth in financial terms as the only model of value. And I'd really welcome some stories from the panel about other approaches and other values within the context of startup to market, because they don't need to be the same thing.
Thank you.
I've got one example, actually.
Go ahead.
We're doing both. We're looking at, obviously, high growth, because obviously there's value for not just for the individual, but also community as a whole. But also we're working with the Biospheric Foundation in Manchester, Vincent Walsh, who managed to persuade Manchester County Council to give £1 million for his PhD to create a three-storey aquaponics kind of green tech installation that would explore the possibility of reducing the food mileage and the carbon emissions on creating local farms in the city, so that individuals can then farm for themselves, produce food locally through, you know, a local network, rather than relying on ye olde Tesco, Aldi, Sainsbury's, which totally undercut the, you know, the average farmer who's got 300 or 400 acres. And so I'm pursuing a similar model at the moment with something called Green Labs, which is exploring with a kind of a 2-acre project down in the Isle of Man to make certain parts of their community self-sustainable. So it's kind of a double-edged sword from my perspective. Yeah, I think there is a lot of value in, because different people have got different, you know, outlooks, different approaches, and I totally accept that. And I've got, you know, two sides of my brain, like kind of Jekyll and Hyde, I suspect. And so the Etsy model, to me, offers that kind of freedom of expression, a route that you could, like a plan B. Your plan A is you work for Deutsche Bank during day, and at night you're doing something else. So it's that kind of...
the way around,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, of course, yeah, yeah. Really, yeah, yeah. So I think there's a space for it. And I think Fab Labs, historically, because it came from MIT, obviously a centre of excellence, have, looking at the network as it's grown, have always been around social... So it's, I guess, change for good. And a lot of the projects you see through the academy and alumni networks I'm part of, FabConnect, FabLabs.io, are all around creating either solutions to problems that face not just the West, but also, you know, other countries. There's one they recently previewed, I think it's in Peru, and they were, by day, they had a huge crate of plants that obviously created energy and they grew food. And at night, you flicked a switch and it became a spotlight from the power generated by the plants. So it's using two different... Yeah, and that, yeah, I totally across that and I'm totally supportive.
Yeah. Anyone else like to comment on the question of are we obsessed with high growth?
That's a great question. I've been biting my tongue up here because, yeah, I'm totally in the small, beautiful boat because, I think small-scale local manufacturing really is the future, and actually being able to do that anywhere in the world and not just relying on consuming mass-manufactured goods. It is a mark of success for some people, but it absolutely disregards all the other important things about living and being a human, things like having skills and having communities and an agency over the world that we live in. So it's really important to think. I think there's loads of examples of really successful, committing to that small scale and understanding that the value that your business has isn't just making loads of money. The value is that you're creating skilled jobs in your local area. Like the value is that you're sustaining your own income, and also that you're able to experiment and create new interesting pieces of work. So there's a whole array of kind of things to do with that, and kind of I think it's a everyone does what they want to, like, is in charge of their own businesses, but I think respecting the small ones is also very important.
I mean, I think there's a bunch of thousands of small manufacturing companies in the UK, but what we've seen recently is they're all transitioning up the value chain, and they're all going from the people that used to make sheet metal shelving for Asda are now making cockpits and military devices and aerospace, all those things, and they're just charging higher margin on less products, which means people like me going into those factories, I can't have a conversation with them because they only want high margin. And I think for us, our objective is to change the way that every community in the world uses energy, and we want every community to be able to access our technology. And the only way for us to do that is to achieve massive industrial scale. We want to list the business eventually, and I guess to convince investors to give us the capital to even start, we had to have a massive vision. And we've now, have 45 staff employed in the space of making. I found that I couldn't employ engineers in the DFM space in London. I have to open office in Cambridge to get all that, the brains there to work really well. But there's a lot of great small maker communities there that will access and use the manufacturing. But I think that you have to think big to make macro change. So we've kind of got a really big vision here. And we know that I can't make my first product cost me £5,000. That's how much I sold it for. Now we manufacture products for $200. And so we've done that first scale jump, but I'm about to make the next scale jump from $200 down to $20. And I need to really scale. But otherwise, it's all about scale to give me those kind of movements and prices.
I'm just curious about the sustainability of the products that you produce and how they affect the environment within your areas.
I think that's a really good question, and we shouldn't necessarily just be making products really for the sake of it. It's all well and good developing companies and people having more jobs, but we shouldn't be making more landfill. So as a designer, I feel very responsible for every product I make and how much impact it has and the process that it goes through when it's being made and the end life of that. I just think it's really about design education and making people understand that certain materials, you need to find a way to actually recycle them. So, for example, having a monoplastic car, something like this, it's really the future.
I was picking up on your question and just wondering whether there's a broader question. I think we talked about it earlier about kind of taste or the kind of consumer demand on all of this stuff. And I wonder whether you're seeing that people are asking for... are asking questions about kind of circular practice in the way things are made?
I think there's an argument around the psychology of marketing involved in this somewhere where we're actually told what we want, which is the iPhone is a great example. 20 years ago, when I was a kid, we didn't have mobile phones, obviously the raw benefit. But the iPhone is a great example of it's a thing you lust after or you want. Yeah, so that's an example of marketing, and that can be applied to any field of product design. And there's a... I think that's more of a kind of political debate about why do we need product X over Y? Okay, it helps us save energy through kinetic motion. Great, let's use it on mass and solar energy. If we can increase the utilization to 100% per cell, great, let's use it on mass.
Mm-hmm. I think it really should be a push thing from the designers. It's very hard to get people to just buy particular goods that are more environmentally sustainable. So I think you just need to make sure from designing it that's a prerogative of theirs.
And there's also cost. If I go to, I'm going to give an example of food. If I go into a supermarket and buy organic chicken, it's more expensive than normal chicken, which is okay. We're supposed to be given free range of an opportunity. Or if you if it goes to the butchers, it's actually more expensive than the organic because they don't actually do any plastic packaging on the meat itself. So there's a cost in there as well, which kind of is contrary to what we're trying to do. Yeah. And you have to pay more for the recycled and more for the organic, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I wonder whether, Lawrence, baked into the kind of ethos behind your business is kind of environmental principle, I guess. But how easy is it to kind of follow the kind of pure environmental kind of circular economy principles?
Yeah, so, I mean, I used to work at E.ON. I was asked to join a team to develop a new form of street lighting that would be powered by solar energy and by wind. This was in 2008, and they asked me to come with this team to develop these solutions. After working for a year with them, we led an investment into an LED company. We partnered with a solar research institute in Loughborough. We found that it actually was not viable to make solar-powered streetlights in urban spaces because there wasn't very good sunlight, and there's issues with shading, and also with wind. There isn't really good wind internally, and microgeneration doesn't work. So I came out of that having failed, like hanging my head in shame, came up with the idea for this paved gen and using energy from footsteps. But I guess I came from the generation when like sustainability had been banged into us like from day one. It only just like really became a big deal in design teaching. So we said, okay, well, let's use the top surface of our product. Let's use recycled truck tyres. So we'll get the truck tyres, we'll add a bit of urethane binder, and we'll make the top surface of our product that. Now, it did cost me about 50% more to do it, but we found it was really important to take things off the road and then obviously put them back in after recycling them. We then started using recycled polymer concrete in the main product. It did have a massive cost implications, but we believed that it would actually stand true and like we should keep going with it. Then if you look at the bigger industry, like a third of PET bottles in the United States are recycled and used to make carpet. When I'm sitting with Mohawk Carpets, who are one of the biggest like flooring companies in the world, they say, yeah, we charge 40% premium because it's eco, and we can do that, and that's their ethos behind it. Now, I think if you look at the big picture here, like there's something fundamentally wrong in the way we're making products. Like every time, like Tim Cook from Apple tweets, everyone buys a new iPhone like that. Whenever he tells his team there's a new iPhone, everyone's queuing. Like, I feel like I need the new iPhone. I don't know why. I just feel like it's a status thing. Like, why is that? It comes down to this thing.
Android rocks.
Yeah, there you go. Android's better. But I think we need to move to a service economy. And if people... There's a story of someone who made this amazing razor, and it was so great that everyone bought one, and then no one bought one again. And then when Interface Floor, another flooring company, started renting out their carpet as a service... Suddenly, they made a carpet to last 30 years rather than 5. And I think, why did I buy a washing machine the other day? Let's rent that, and let's make them the built-in obsolescence. I think Victor Papanek did a lot about the white goods papers. Is how do we make something as a like an awesome service product that will last for decades and decades and decades, and maybe we'll just put a new widget in it every now and then? And I think we need to think about that, and not enough people are doing it. So we'd love, as PaveGen, to transition into that, and we're thinking a lot about it at the moment, and that might be something we release in the next kind of year or so.
There's something called the $8 shave. Have anybody seen the video of the $8 shave? We had P&G in our lab the other week, and I showed them the Great Recovery team had taken apart some razor blades on our wall and got a different disassembly bits of plastic. And we said, look, you don't really need 3 blades. It's all about marketing. They didn't really smile at that one. Because you obviously can shave with a single blade. But I think the $8 shave is where this young aspiring American took a concept of release the blade. So when the flat... Flat, when they're not very sharp, sorry, send them back to us, recycle them, and send you back some sharper blades. So that model of leasing the product works really well. And also clothing. There's some high street brands are looking to lease almost like clothing, man-made fibres that can be sent to you, you wear them. You got sick of them, you send them back, they recycle them to something else, and they come back. So you may be wearing somebody else's underpants, obviously not, or a T-shirt or whatever. So there's that model, I think, works much better, like the leasing the carpet, the sofa, the TV, but I think the manufacturers to work out how do we, and when we take back the product, how we then break it down and then send back the same thing again that'll last another 30 years.
Yeah,
I don't think we're there yet, but obviously metals are a lot easier. Yeah.
Thank you very much. We're running out of time very quick. We've covered a lot. Thank you very much for all the discussions. I think, from everything from fake it till you make it to the kind of principles of the MakeWorks experiment, I guess, to kind of go out and meet people and build the trust through that. I think there's a huge number of lessons for life, if not just for the maker economy. So can you join me in thanking our panellists, Roland, Fee, Lawrence and Andy?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.